Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Healthy Tuesday, Elizabeth. Where are we going today?
We are... I'm not sure where we're going today, to be perfectly honest. I am along for the ride, which I guess in all honesty, I'm along for the ride every week, but I have more of a sense of kind of the direction. But this week, it's a topic that I have purposely in some ways kind of let myself slide to the side. Because I'm going to let our guest be the expert, which is a whole challenge for me in another story, in another lifetime. But yes, I'm going to move aside a little bit, let my guest take the lead on the story. But we're going to talk about the field of psychiatry and the growing edges of the field of psychiatry moving in and I'm not going to say the entire field is moving in this direction of more functional psychopharmacology, but there is movement in parts of the field to step away from strictly writing prescriptions for antidepressants, anti-anxiety, antipsychotics, and to start looking at the possibility of utilizing medications short-term in conjunction with ACT, which is acceptance commitment therapy. And we actually had someone on talking about that a couple of months ago, you might remember. So these two in combination are, the intent is to bring not just relief from the symptoms, which really is what happens with the medications, but to actually bring along relief of the symptoms and to work on symptom tolerance, which I'm really excited to talk about today, because I think one of the big, I'm not going to say big lies, but big fairy tales of mental health treatment is that there's a point when you are over all of your mental health issues and will never suffer from any sort of mental health crisis again, that we will hit that magic place we call healing or healed. And you never really hear healed. You always hear healing, that we get there and somehow then we never suffer again. And I think the fact that that narrative lives out there, that there is a place of healing that we would never suffer again, causes a lot of people to suffer much more than they should, because that frustration or disappointment or feeling like a failure when you don't have symptom relief or you don't feel like you're healing or getting over this or, you know, reducing your discomfort sinks us deeper into that hole and that struggle. And so one of the things I was interested about the functional psychopharmacology is the idea that we're looking for promoting functioning with the use of medications, but also with the ACT, helping people develop symptom tolerance, which will allow them to have a higher quality of life. So the reason this is important is because in 2016, so we're talking 5 years ago, 1 in 6 adults were on some sort of either antidepressant, anti-anxiety medication, or antipsychotic. That was up from 1 in 10 adults in 2011. And I wasn't able to find any current research, which is distressing, but I'm hoping that our guests will be able to fill us in. But my fear is that in 2021, that 1 in 6 has gotten higher, especially with the year we've spent in COVID and the increase of people presenting with depression and anxiety. That's a lot of people to be on medications. It's a lot of people to be taking medications when the medications aren't going to fix the problem. They just kind of put you on hold. And the other thing that's distressing is that the older you are as an adult, the higher rate of use of psychiatric drugs. So a quarter of the adults ages 60 to 85 are on some sort of antidepressant, anti-anxiety, or sedative-like medication, which is another conversation Dr. McGee and I will have to have. But the story this week is that in the last 40 years, and it's been longer. It's been since the 1950s when we first started looking at antipsychotics to help people who are institutionalized. But for the last 40 years, there's been a concentrated effort to look for a pill for that, a pill for everything. Do you remember restless leg syndrome? That was a thing for a while. And it was supposed to be connected to anxiety. And there happened to be a pill that was made for that. But the pill wasn't actually working. And so you stopped hearing about restless leg syndrome. And that's just one small example of all of the ways that there's been a pill for that in the last 40 years. The problem is it's made pharmaceutical companies incredibly wealthy and the people that run them and invest in them incredibly wealthy, but it hasn't improved the life of the amount of people that have been prescribed pharmaceuticals. Now, having said that, I want to make sure I caveat that in the 40, 50, 60 years that these medications have been developed and have been put in use, for some people, for a portion of our population, 1% of them, these medications have been life-saving. There would be no life for them or functioning without these medications. And it's important to bear that in mind, that this is not an anti-medication, never medication conversation, because for some people, there is no life quality for them without them. But let's put that segment of the population aside, which is supposed to be about 1% of those people that are struggling with mental health issues. But if we're medicating 1 in 6 people, that is way more people than 1% of our population. And so what is the story there? What happens once people go down the path of utilizing antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications? Because it's not an easy exit. There is not an easy exit plan for the use of these medications. Usually when people start on them, they're told by their primary care physician, who is the primary person that are writing these medications, not psychiatrists, that they'll just be on this for the rest of their life. And if you try to come off of these medications, the weaning can be more distressing, more physically debilitating than the symptoms you are feeling that put you on those medications to begin with. So I want to talk about this shift towards functional psychopharmacology. And Dr. Michael McGee has kindly volunteered, hand raised, to be the person to come and talk about this shift. Dr. Michael McGee has been a guest multiple times on the show. He is a psychiatrist. He is also an author. The Joy of Recovery is one of his books, and he has a new book coming out in the next few months called Healing Emotional Pain. Dr. McGee considers himself a reluctant prescriber. I think that's how we termed it. He's board certified in general psychiatry, addiction psychiatry, and psychosomatic medicine. He has extensive experience in addictions treatment, consultation, liaison psychiatry, geriatric psychiatry, and general adult psychiatry. And Dr. McGee also lives here in San Luis Obispo. So I'm looking forward to our conversation. And although we can't take calls as we traditionally do, you can call with questions, 805-549-8855, and we'll read those questions over the air, 805-549-8855. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And this week, we are week 3 going live on our Instagram. So if you'd like to join the show on Instagram live, check us out. Just go to The Reluctant Therapist, at The Reluctant Therapist, and you'll see Dr. McGee and myself. And you can follow us on Facebook, or you can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. As always, you can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org, and you can podcast our show to share with friends by visiting Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have trouble finding us, again, ask your child or your next door neighbor's child or your grandchildren, because they know far more about all of this than any of us. So here we are. Thanks for tuning in. I'm looking forward to seeing where Dr. McGee takes us this week. We'll be back in a moment to start the conversation. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Forget your troubles, come on, get happy. You better chase all your cares away. Shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. Get ready for the judgment day. The sun is shining, come on, get happy. The Lord is waiting to take your hand. Shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. We're going to the promised land. We're heading across the river, wash your sins away in the tide. It's all so peaceful on the other side. Forget your troubles, come on, get happy. You better chase all your cares away. Shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. Get ready for the judgment day. Forget your troubles, come on, get happy. Chase your cares away. Hallelujah, get happy. judgment day. The sun is shining, come on, get happy. The Lord is waiting to take your hand. Shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. We're gonna be going to the promised land.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And there's something kind of dark about using that song today, Michael. As soon as I heard it, we got Judy Garland singing Get Happy, and boy, did she suffer at the hands of over prescribing.
Yeah. I appreciated your thoughts, Elizabeth, and thanks for having me on your show. I've been going through my own personal professional crisis a little bit around medications. I recently was introduced to the work of Robert Whittaker. I'm almost hesitant to mention his name. He has created a lot of controversy. He has a website called Mad in America.
I know his work.
You do?
Yes,
yeah.
I do.
So I'm on a personal project right now of soliciting critiques of his work and analyzing his work and understanding where his voice fits in. He's a real polemic for an anti-medication, anti-psychiatry approach, but he has a lot of really wonderful, wonderful insights and to provide us, especially in terms of using antipsychotics and antidepressants. A lot of what you said is very, very true. I'm changing my practice now towards not being so free and willing to prescribe these medications unless there is a really careful discussion of the potential downsides of going on these medications, including possibly changing the brain in a way that makes the brain need these medications long term. I'm talking about antidepressants and antipsychotics. So I'd like to talk a little bit today about a new paradigm change, which I see evolving in psychiatry, called functional psychiatry or mindful psychiatry. Those are two different terms. And they really recast the role of medications. I'd like to say to begin with that the medications are, like you said, sometimes very life-saving. I had a patient I saw this morning with severe heroin addiction and attention deficit disorder who was just, when I first met him about 10 years ago, he was devastated and really had had a couple of overdoses and was homeless, practically unemployed, not able to function at all. And he's on a medicine called buprenorphine now that he's been on for about 10 years, which changes the rate of recovery from heroin addiction or opiate use disorder from about a 10% recovery in 1 year to about a 70 to 80 or more percent recovery in 1 year. It's really almost as close to a miracle drug as there is. And I have him on Adderall now for his ADHD, and he's gone from being homeless and almost and to having a stable, loving family, being a great citizen, a successful career. He recently got a second home that he's had the financial resources to be able to get, just blossoming beautifully. And most of my patients are in that situation. I love psychiatry because for the right people with the right problem, these medications can be life-saving and life-transforming. But more and more now, I'm finding myself seeing patients where I'm declining to prescribe. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that. I had one person who came in. His wife actually sent him in, go change your antidepressant, she told him. And he came in, and it turned out that there was so much crisis and stress in their lives around his wife's children who were suffering from addiction and creating a lot of legal issues and crisis. It had really affected him and his wife, and they had really a lot of conflict between the two of them. He was not taking care of himself, wasn't exercising. And rather than putting him on an antidepressant, I referred him for couples therapy and began to work with him on some of the acceptance and commitment therapy approaches that hopefully I can mention here today with him. And now I'm happy to say that without medication intervention, with just psychotherapy, he's doing great. So that's an example of the kind of situation where we need to be careful with medications.
And I love that you started off with two kind of polar examples, because I think that speaks volumes to what we need to be talking about every day. You know, there is a huge spectrum of one mental health crises, big spectrum, and there's a big spectrum in how we should be addressing them. And it seems that, you know, we have tried to make things simple by narrowing down what those options are into very small, you know, definitions. And also, of course, managed care has narrowed what kind of treatment people can get, which is another part. There's a lot of directions we want to go. And I want to reintroduce you again. Dr. Michael McGee is my guest today. He's the author of Joy of Recovery. His new book is Healing Emotional Pain. And he also wrote 101 Things to Know If You're Addicted to Painkillers. So you know your stuff around all of these areas. And how long have you been practicing? It's been quite a while.
About 32 years now.
So you've seen, and I'm not sure if there was a heavy leaning on medication prescriptions when you went through medical school, but were you part of the wave that went from talk therapy to just writing prescriptions to where we are now? Have you been part of that whole wave?
Yes, I have. When I first went to training, I went to the Massachusetts Mental Health Center, which was a Harvard program in Boston area, because I wanted psychoanalytic training. And I remember interviewing at the University of in California in San Francisco, UCSF, and they said to me, "You're swimming against the tide. Everything's biological psychiatry." And so I rode that wave of believing that the answers would be in medications, and it's just turned out that to be partially true, a little bit. For a significant number of people, but not true for many more. And we live in a society where I think one of the underlying problems is we are a conditioned to comfort society that is extremely distress avoidant. And we equate being uncomfortable or in pain or anxious or even depressed as bad, that these are bad, bad, bad feelings to have. We equate any kind of pain as being bad. And boy, that is probably the biggest source of suffering and disability. It is our avoidance of pain because our labeling of pain as something bad. And that doesn't exist in a lot of other cultures. It is kind of human that if it feels bad, that it is bad. We do that as a species in general. But a lot of other cultures that have to put up with a lot of distress and suffering and inconvenience take pain as a normal, natural routine part of life, much more than we do. So that's a central problem that really needs to be addressed.
It feels chicken and the egg a little bit, though. Was it because these medications were developed, and so then we started telling people you don't have to feel pain? The pills were offered up, and then people said, "Oh, okay."
Yes. I mean, well, it's natural. I mean, if you're in pain and there's a pill that can take it away, how seductive is that? Mm-hmm. We bought into that promise rather than getting to the root of what's causing the pain and honoring our symptoms as what I would call sacred messengers. What is our depression trying to tell us? We've evolved to develop depression as a way of paralyzing and freezing us because our way of living ain't working. There's stop, 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 pull back, disengage, shut down, reevaluate. Now, obviously there are some people who I treat for depression where there's just a neurobiological vulnerability to that has little or no meaning perhaps, or maybe a small component of meaning in terms of how skillfully one is living one's life. So there are exceptions to this for sure. But a lot of people who are getting depressed are treating their depression as an enemy that needs to be alleviated with a pill rather than honoring it as a symptom, which is trying to tell them something very important that they need to listen to.
And I think one of the struggles is that it's when you step into a place of psychic distress, that's your entire being saying you need to address this. It generally isn't going to relief, you know, you're not going to find relief in a week or 2 weeks or a month. That those psychic journeys can take a year. And I think that's one of the challenges as well is if you were to say to someone, you know, I know this depression or I know the anxiety is really uncomfortable and impeding, you know, that your life. Yet if you stay with this and do the work in 6 months to a year, you will, you know, feel better again. Or here is this, you know, idea that I might give you a pill and it alleviates the pain. I guess what I'm saying is that we want things to heal quickly and they don't.
Yeah, sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. That's exactly right. And we want the pain to go away forever and never have to be in pain. And that kind of attitude, we need to really, really change our attitude towards suffering, that we kind of welcome suffering as a messenger that something's not right. That if we're just uncomfortable, that we're honoring the symptoms because they're indicating a discrepancy between what is wanted and what is received. And that's so important to honor that. So important to honor that. So rather than trying to obliterate distress, which is inevitable, we learn to live with it. We learn to tolerate it. Now, there is a role sometimes if you're having panic attacks, right? Or if you're really in extreme distress, that you literally, it shuts you down and immobilizes you and you're completely incapacitated, then there is a role. This is where functional psychiatry comes in. One of the functions is to basically reduce the distress to the point where it's manageable, if you can, not just with medications, but with other kinds of mind-body interventions as well. But get the distress to the place where it's where you enable the person to lead a valued and meaningful life despite their symptoms. So then you're looking at really modulating or managing or increasing the capacity to bear and endure distress or reduce the distress, maybe temporarily, to tolerable limits while you make the changes you need to make in your way of being in the world, in your way of understanding your world, and in your way of acting in the world. Which you're right, Elizabeth, that takes time sometimes. Sometimes that can take a lifetime of work.
Right, but that we cycle in and out of it. Yeah. Because every time we transition through a job or through grief or loss, there is going to be a period of adjustment, which can bring about periods of time that we're in that depressed mode. And as you said, that depressive mindset or that depressive position has a purpose. You know, we need to go inward to heal from grief. We need to go inward to adjust to even something joyful like having a new baby. I think we really focused on this postpartum depression as some sort of psychic break when what really is happening is that women move into this depressive position so that they slow down and focus on the child, which it's a whole nother show about not having enough parental leave to let women get through the process. But here's my dilemma, Dr. Michael McGee. I've been doing the show since 2007. I have been concerned about the rate of medications since I went through school, through my graduate programs, and saw this turning tide. And I teach this to my students that, you know, 1% of the population absolutely needs some sort of medical intervention or medication to survive. But the rest of the people that are medicated, 13% of them, are not receiving any benefits from it. And in some ways, they're being harmed by the medications because they don't work and then you add more medications on. And I can tell you only one time that someone has said, gosh, I think I'm probably that person who shouldn't be medicated. Every other person, students, listeners, clients, has said, I know I'm in that 1%. I know that I couldn't live without it. And I think that's the big challenge, is that people, I don't know if they want to believe that theirs is so specific that they have the biological depression, or they've been told the story that it's biological. And so anytime someone counters that, they stop listening because they've bought into the biological. Like, that's how do we shift the whole narrative that people believe, well, everyone else is probably not needing medications, but I absolutely do.
Yeah. That's a really, really, really good question. I don't have the answer. I mean, for me, I'm shifting the narrative by one patient at a time.
I hear you. I have a lofty, you know, it's been a while now. I've been singing this song, so.
Yeah, I think there's just a need to be speaking out about this. A lot of my colleagues are just not even aware of these issues. And one of the travesties, I think, of managed care and our current healthcare system is the way that that psychiatry has been dumbed down to a 15-minute medication visit. I almost feel like that's malpractice. I really do. And I think the delinking of practicing psychopharmacology without some sort of functional psychiatry approach with it, some psychotherapy that addresses the underlying solutions to the underlying problems that are manifesting these symptoms, I think it's a disservice to people. But you know what? It's such a difficult problem, because if you're a psychiatrist and you're working in an insurance delivered system, you're going to be really squeezed into one of these pill mill type models, which I feel is just a terrible way to practice psychiatry, at least for me anyway.
And the other part of the narrative is that if you're someone of means and you're struggling with your mental health or your children are struggling, you're going to say, oh, we're going to go to a psychiatrist because that's the highest level of care we could get for mental health issues. And so I think another disservice that a lot of people have taken their children or taken themselves to a psychiatrist and been prescribed a medication, and they think that's the best because, of course, a psychiatrist must know more than an MFT or an LCSW. And so that is another part of the narrative that has pushed so many people into the wrong direction.
Yes, you're right. That is a false narrative. The quality of one's efficacy as a healer, if one has what I would call a non-melancholic depression, or an adjustment issue, or generalized anxiety, the quality, a lot of these issues. I want to back up and say a lot of these issues are manifestations of trauma. And I think trauma is really grossly underrecognized in society, and the roots of very subtle forms of trauma. I think we live in a spiritually traumatizing society in many ways, with all of our judgments and all of our values that we have in terms of what makes a person a worthy, lovable human being. It's not in terms of loving and being loved and connecting and belonging. It's in terms of social status and where you are on the various ladder, social hierarchy ladders that we all buy into. And really that leads to a lot of depression and a lot of anxiety. And the treatment is not to numb that out with a pill. The treatment is to see what I call our love wound, and to see our love wound and see how that love wound is manifesting in terms of these symptoms, and really get to a healing of that love wound. And I've developed a method, which I'd be happy to share with you all, for doing that kind of work. But that's where we need to go. And that's not a work that only a psychiatrist can do. Any clinician with good training can do that kind of work.
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest is Dr. Michael McGee. He is a board certified psychiatrist. He has written 3 books, Joy of Recovery, Healing Emotional Pain, which will be coming out in the next couple of months, and 101 Things to Know If You're Addicted to Painkillers. And he is here today to talk about his personal journey through his profession and through his practice, and these shifts that he's making in his work towards more functional psychiatry or mindful psychiatry. And that's what we're going to spend the next part of the show talking about, exactly what this kind of shift in the world of treatment of mental health is going, and where hopefully people will be able to seek relief. Although we don't have the phones open traditionally, you can call with a question. Our number is 805-549-8855. And we also are going live today. If you do Instagram, you can jump onto the Reluctant Therapist Instagram, give us a wave, and you can see Dr. McGee and myself. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back to continue this conversation. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Left here on my own, so that's sin. I've got to leave before I start to scream. Pull someone out the door and took the key. You're feeling all right. Uh-huh. I'm not feeling too good myself. Uh-huh. Yes, sir. You're feeling all right. Uh-huh. I'm not feeling.
And it is 2:31 here at Public Radio KCBX. Be sure and join us, of course, at 2 o'clock for Fresh Air. Time now to return to The Reluctant Therapist on KCBX.
All right, so Dr. Mike McGee, we're going to dive into functional psychopharmacology or functional psychiatry, mindful psychiatry. I'm really excited to talk about kind of the shift. What does that look like for people who are coming into your office? This idea that you're going to use the short-term use of meds with ACT, acceptance commitment therapy, to promote functioning and symptom tolerance. Let's talk about that defined work first.
Sure. So for functional psychopharmacology, the metric that you want to use is living a valued life. That's really what you're looking at in terms of functionality. What's important to me? What are my values? What are my goals? And really, how am I achieving leading a life which is meaningful and valuable to me?
So how does that differ from what people traditionally were coming into a psychiatric office, and what was their expectation as opposed to this new look?
Yeah. So the trap is using medications to promote avoidance of pain.
Okay. So that's the big difference.
That's the big difference, right? And the function of medications are not to numb pain or necessarily. I mean, it's always a good thing to reduce pain, I suppose, or it can be a very good thing to reduce pain. But the function of medications is to promote acting to live the life that you want. It's to decrease avoidance. It's to promote acceptance of having symptoms, to have the life that you want to live. It's about really helping people to be successful in realizing a life which is meaningful to them despite their symptoms.
So the symptoms are become part of the narrative, but not the definition of the person.
Right, exactly. I mean, part of this is to really value symptoms and to really see them as messengers that are telling us that there's something not quite right here. There's a problem. And to really honor those symptoms rather than to label them as bad and just wanting to get rid of them. Now, there are times when you have neurobiological dysregulations. I mean, I have a patient with really severe bipolar depression, a bipolar depression who is absolutely immobilized with thoughts that he is evil and that he's possessed by demons, and that he, whenever anybody is around them, he emanates such evil demonic energy that he's poisoning and killing other people around him. Now, something like that, you want to treat that aggressively with medications, right? But for, I would say, if we can call this sort of the calm in depression and anxiety, if we're going to use medications, it really has to be to really promote functioning rather than used to promote avoidance of pain.
So how long of the course of treatment? Because as I mentioned at the top of the show, none of these medications are benign. You don't go on them and then just jump off, right?
Right, right. Exactly. Yeah, that's another thing that's very important. If you're going to go on an antipsychotic or an antidepressant, you have to do so very, very, very thoughtfully, knowing that there is some indication in the literature. Now, the literature on this is a little bit conflicting, but there is some indication that these medications change the mind, and antipsychotics can maybe make you more vulnerable to psychosis long-term, and antidepressants may make you more vulnerable to depression long-term. So the decision to go on them is one that should be made readily when they're needed, but reluctantly and cautiously. And if you can deal with depression or anxiety without medications, then you're probably much better off in the long run if you can avoid medications.
And the thing that, again, the narrative is the challenge. Primary care physicians, who are the ones that are primarily writing these prescriptions, don't have training in it, right? They're not trained in mental health care. Right. And so they'll tell people, and I've heard many a story of this, you have to take these meds because you are sick. It's a biological illness, depression, anxiety, and you need to be on these, just like diabetes. I mean, this is the narrative that people are being told. So they might be perfectly able to deal with the symptoms and find ways to deal with it. But when we're telling people who are going and seeking help that they are sick and need these meds, how do you deal with that? How do you change that narrative?
I know that's a real difficult one. There's a real need for a change in our whole society towards the attitude that we have towards symptoms of depression and anxiety. Rather than seeing us as sick, we can see us, it depends on how you define sick. I suppose one could say that one is suffering and maybe sick in a way, but everything is psychological and biological, both. It's not an either or. The mind and the brain are intimately interconnected to each other, and mind affects brain and brain affects mind. And there's a reciprocal interaction there. And these symptoms of depression, anxiety, if we want to call them a sickness, they can manifest from either, maybe a purely biological component, but they can manifest also from the way that we're living our lives. Mm-hmm. And if that is the source of the symptoms of the problem, then we really need to look at our way of experiencing ourselves and others, and our understanding of ourselves and others, and how we're living our lives, and the way that how we're living our lives. Are we living a balanced life of what I call work, love, play, and health? Mm-hmm. Are those all in equal balance? Work, love, play, and health. Are we living a value coherent life that is really love based? Are we? Let's look at the way we're living our lives. Are we taking good care of ourselves? Are we living where we're compelled, for example, by trauma, to, in a compulsive way, try and heal our trauma or numb our wounds in ways that are compulsive and unhelpful? These are the kind of things we need to really be looking at deeply when we're looking at. And you can't do that in a 10-minute visit to your primary care physician. And I'm not even sure we have enough therapists in this area that could provide people all the treatment that we need. We have a crisis in our healthcare system in terms of even being able to provide people with the kind of treatment that they would benefit from.
I know, and that's another good point. If we can get people to even seek out the therapy that might give them symptom tolerance. I want to keep going back to that, because that's the revolution back. That's, I don't know if it's a revolution, that's a return back to the training that I received. They said, our work is not to fix or heal our clients, but to give them the tools to tolerate what is intolerable so that they can continue living their lives.
Exactly. That is the fundamental kind of principle of acceptance commitment therapy. What we want to do is when we take a look at our lives, we want to do kind of three things apart from symptoms. We want to look at what's called context sensitivity or workability, which is, the sort of the classic Dr. Phil line, how's that working for you? and is your attempts to avoid your pain, is that working for you? Is right. isolating working for you? Is drinking working for you, or whatever you're doing to avoid and numb your pain? And then the second component is really helping people to develop sort of an openness to their experience, including their pain, and take off the label, take out the second arrow, as they say, of judging your pain to be something bad and terrible. It's just pain, right? So you kind of take the suffering. That's what my next book is about, is really taking the suffering out of pain so that it's just clean pain that we can learn from and that we can honor.
Don't jump away from that, because that is such a powerful visual. And you've said it before, and I don't want to go back, that when we get shot with an arrow, I think that's this way you tell a story, you feel the pain of the arrow going into you. That's pain. But right. It's how we respond to that pain that causes the long-term suffering.
Exactly. And makes it worse. This is going to be a provocative statement, Elizabeth, but I'll say it anyway. I would propose, and this is worth reflection on, that probably the bulk of human suffering is caused by how we multiply our pain by avoiding our pain.
Give an example.
Well, for example, I'm anxious with other people. I've experienced a lot of trauma growing up with people maybe bullying me, let's say, for example. So I avoid other people because I'm anxious of being around them. I don't feel worthy of being in relationship with other people. I'm anxious about their judgments of me. So I'm going to use marijuana and alcohol to feel better. And I'll hook up with people where I can safely bond and connect with them through alcohol and marijuana, rather than maybe be with people who I feel like I'm not worthy to be with. That would be, I can think of 1,000 examples, but that would be one example.
Right. So the story is you're feeling the pain, and boy, if I had a dollar for every person who has told me they suffer from social anxiety disorder, I would be a wealthy clinician, because it is, to me, you're describing this whole social idea that when I'm uncomfortable with people, the way we fix that is by not being around people. And so right. it magnifies, if I'm hearing you correctly, you have this anxiety of the social anxiety. And so you magnify it by avoiding people, hibernating, playing video games, and then having to drink or do drugs to go into public. You just, again, that is the definition of masking or numbing the pain and exacerbating the suffering tenfold. But again, how do we overcome that story? Because when I talk about that, the response is, but it's a diagnosis. I have this. And so, you're just tuning in, I just want to reintroduce my guest today, Dr. Michael McGee. He is a board certified psychiatrist, the author of 3 different books. And he's talking about the shift, the subtle shift that's happening in the field of psychiatry. And he's on the cutting edge of this movement towards functional psychiatry, the short-term use of medications, but along with acceptance commitment therapy to help promote functioning and symptom tolerance. And our number, one more time, is 805-549-8855, if you have a question. All right, so Dr. McGee, we started off, I interrupted you, the 2 parts of the acceptance commitment therapy.
Okay, so there's really three parts to that. And the first part is doing what's called context analysis or really context sensitivity and asking yourself, how is that working for you, right? And then the second part is really sort of basically in increasing your openness and your capacity to bear distress. And we talked a little bit about taking away these negative judgments that this is a terrible, terrible thing. This is a painful thing, but maybe this is the best thing I could ever experience if I embrace this in the right way. Maybe this is my way out, my liberation to a new way of living that is going to really be fundamentally, profoundly rewarding if I just honor my pain and listen to it and really inquire deeply into the roots of it. And then the third part is to go out and just do it, is to go out and take action based on your values. What's most important and meaningful to you to lead a life that would be valuable? So if it's important to be with family, for example, even though you're depressed and you don't feel like you have much energy, you open yourself up to loving connection with people rather than isolating, even though it's difficult to get out and do that. If you're anxious and let's say you have a hard time driving because you're anxious on the road, you may work with a psychiatrist to maybe take the edge off that temporarily while you learn different kinds of cognitive behavioral techniques for managing anxiety, and then go out and practice exposing yourself and doing what you need to do to reframe your experience so that you can do what you need to do to have a fulfilling life. And so those are the 3 basic pillars of acceptance commitment therapy.
And so I'm hearing good old fashioned exposure therapy.
Well, that's one tiny part of it, right? That's one tiny part of it is you want to promote what I call engagement. If you didn't have this problem, if there was a miracle, what I ask my patients sometimes is if I could wave a magic wand and do a miracle and take your problem away, what would your life be like? What would you be doing, right? and really get people to articulate that. And then when I see them in my work with medications, I'll ask them, okay, how you doing on work? 1 to 10, how you doing on work? Okay, you're a 7 on work, great. How you doing on play? A 3? A 2? You're only a 2 out of 10? Okay, let's see. Well, how are you doing on love? And how are you doing on health? So I'll actually have them score those. And then as we'll talk about, okay, what's a small step that you could make? It sounds to me like I have one patient right now I'm working with who has been a priest. And play in his religious tradition was not something that was emphasized. So my work with him is to really encourage him to play. And it's so difficult for him. But the treatment for his depression is to really get him to have more fun and take life a little bit less seriously. To take it both seriously but playfully at the same time. So that's kind of how we work in terms of engagement, is asking that magic. One thing I do is ask that magic wand question and then ask people what small steps they could take to realize the life that they would love to be living.
And I wonder how disappointing it is for people, because when you say that, it feels so obvious and so simple that I would imagine the pushback is, but I'm in too much pain for that, Dr. McGee. That can't be the answer, right? I'm the one who needs more medication. I can't just go play and feel better. I think that must be a challenge, especially when you're a psychiatrist. There's the whole Freud idea of, you know, big, deep thinking dives into dreams. And you're saying, just go have some fun.
Well, there is pushback. And again, I think it's important that people understand what they're getting themselves into. If somebody comes to me and says, well, all I want are pills and here's why, then that involves a dialogue. And it's not always black and white, Elizabeth. Sometimes you're working in the gray, right? And you kind of have to meet people where they're at and help them to make an informed decision, knowing the risk, benefits, side effects, pros and cons. But you can make your clear recommendations. But in that context, I will sometimes say, I'm sorry, I really think that in this situation, you were doing well before. I really think, you know, you started smoking and you stopped going to the gym when COVID hit, and now you're depressed. And I really think that before I give you medication, I really think it would be best to get back into recovery from your tobacco addiction and get back to exercising. And then let's see how you feel after doing that for 3 months. So sometimes you take a stand, and this is where the art comes in. It's difficult. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My guest today is Dr. Michael McGee. We're talking about some subtle shifts in the world of psychiatry towards a mindful psychiatry, not jumping to the prescriptions, which has kind of been the focus of the world of psychiatry for many decades. So how has this changed how you feel about your work, these shifts you're making?
So really good. I feel probably better about my work now than I ever have, because I feel like I'm practicing with a greater degree of benefit. I feel like my benefit with this kind of approach, with a functional psychiatry approach, is more beneficial to people than just having people come in and see them for 5 or 10 or 15 minutes and just give them a pill.
Are you doing full sessions then? Old school 50 minute hours?
Yep. About half my patients I do psychotherapy with. And I love that the most. I love being able to do the medications with the therapy together. That's by far the most fulfilling for me. And it's wonderful that I'm privileged to have the training in both areas, in being a physician and a psychotherapist both. So, but then for my patients that I just do the medications, I will see them for 25 minute visits. I don't do very quick, brief visits. With the exception, there are some patients, for example, who I might have a couple patients who, some patients who are on buprenorphine, like I mentioned, for opiate use disorder, and they're leading these beautiful, stable, highly functioning lives. And I just have to see them for regulatory reasons to make sure that they're sober and that they're stable, and they've been stable for 10, 15, 20 years, And then it can be, hi, how's it going? Good to hear everything's well. I have a patient I saw this morning who has OCD, and he experienced whenever he went up into a high-rise building, an overwhelming sort of thought of throwing himself off the balcony, and it was torturing him. And I've been treating him for many, many years, and he's on an SSRI medication for that. And he's been stable on that medication for maybe 10, 15 years. So for somebody like that, then a quick medication check visit where all systems are go, work, love, play, and health are all at a 10, and there's no side effects and they're doing well. So there is some variation. There is a role, I think, for just a quick medication check for some people, but that's not the case for most people in my experience.
And so how, you know, being a part of the world of psychiatry, are you an outlier? Do your colleagues look at you with suspicion that you're doing this work, or do you feel that there's a bigger movement afoot?
I don't think anybody among my colleagues would disagree with what I'm saying or what I'm teaching. I don't. Do I think I'm an outlier? Maybe. I think so. But there are a few other people. There are colleagues here in San Luis Obispo, for example, friends of mine who are psychiatrists who are very much on this bandwagon. And I do think the field is beginning to move a little bit more in this direction.
So where do you see our biggest challenges in the next few years?
Wow, that's a really good question. I think our whole healthcare system is broken. I think there are insufficient resources. I think that there's a lack of integration of care. We have structures which are fragmenting rather than integrating. There's a two-tiered healthcare system for the Medi-Cal and then for those who have insurance. And then in psychiatry, at least 50% or more of psychiatrists don't even take insurance because it's just such an onerous system that is just so difficult to manage. So I see that as a really big challenge, is the environment that we're practicing in. I think another challenge is that there are so many social determinants of wellness and of mental health that are completely neglected in a biomedical model. We're not looking at things like systemic racism or social injustice or the role of climate pollution, violence, people who grow up in impoverished areas, for example, with a lot of violence, experience great trauma. One out of every one or two people of color grows up witnessing somebody being murdered or severely, severe trauma growing up. People of color are highly, highly, highly traumatized. Many of them are. And that has a huge impact on personality disorders and mental illness and substance abuse. So really getting to issues of social justice and creating way a sort of a trauma-informed biopsychosocial spiritual healthcare system that integrates social interventions with biomedical interventions. I think that's really where we need to go as a field.
You're here. And I think at the root of it goes back to this change in the narrative that life includes suffering, and that learning to tolerate suffering should be taught from a very young age. You know, when doctors ask you, what's your pain scale right now, right? When after surgery, in the olden days, they asked you that and because they expected you to feel pain after surgery. And we moved away from that. So I think that for me, that's the other part of the healing. Until the demand, you know, for relief goes down, it's going to be hard to change the system. So we need to start by raising our children to be more resilient and more able to deal with discomfort and with suffering and with sadness and with loss and social anxiety. Because if we don't start when they're young, we continue to have adults who don't have coping mechanisms.
Beautifully said. That's lovely. Yes.
So my guest today has been Dr. Michael McGee. Dr. McGee, if people want to find your books, where do they find them?
Amazon.com.
That makes it easy. The Joy of Recovery. Dr. McGee's latest book coming out will be Healing Emotional Pain, which touches on a lot of the things that we talked about today. And then also 101 things to know if you're addicted to painkillers. I mean, if you like to talk with Dr. McGee, how do they find you?
So I'm happy to talk to anybody about these issues. My cell phone is 978-360-6071. And my email is MD as in David, M, Michael David McGee, at wellmindlikeahappybrain.com.
And I'm happy to pass that information along if you send me an email to Elizabeth at thereluctanttherapist.com. Thank you to those of you who hung out with us during Instagram Live today. You can follow us on Facebook. You can podcast our show at Apple Podcasts. This link will be up and available for you to share in the next 24 hours. Thank you, Dr. McGee, for spending the hour with us this week. And I look forward to jumping back in next Tuesday at 2. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
A blue shoots up through the stony ground. There's no room, no space to rent in this town. You're out of luck, and the reason that you had to care, the traffic is stuck, and you're not moving anywhere. You thought you found a friend, take you out of this place, someone you can lend a hand in return for grace. It's a beautiful.
Thanks for tuning in to The Reluctant Therapist. This show will be available to listen to later today on our website, kcbx.org. And you can hear any of our local shows anytime and stream on demand from kcbx.org. Find us on social media at kcbxfm.